So, first of all, it might be helpful for me to determine people's level of experience so I know something about where to pitch the teachings. So, is there anybody who's completely new to Buddhism? One and a half? Half new, or is there anybody who's completely new to meditation practice? Just one. Just hang in there. And for those who are unfamiliar with the form, I guess there's various forms that are presented by the Victoria Insight Association. So this day long, I would sort of tend to present it in the form of a contemplative inquiry into various teachings. And I understand that I am somewhere like last year, I gave a title for the day today, and I forgot what the title was. So I was just reminded yesterday. So I think I must have been in Australia because that's the theme of my day long in Australia a year ago. So, but I'll have to ad-lib a little bit maybe. So I think it's something like harmonizing the spiritual path. Is that correct? Does it matter?
It doesn't really matter.
Doesn't really matter. It's all about sort of Buddhism meditation stuff. Yeah, so okay. Well, sometimes it's helpful for me to have a theme because, maybe you can appreciate that the Buddhist teachings are extremely diverse. They cover a wide range, whether you talk about Buddhism as an ism. I've introduced, I think, as a Thai forest tradition or something. Well, many different forms of Buddhism, even monastic forms. Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia, and then that's been slightly adapted in Thailand to give sort of emphasis to their cultural approach in Thailand, and then Sri Lanka and Burma, and it can be quite diverse at a more subtler level. But we try to go back to the teachings of the Buddha, which are recorded basically in what's called the Pali Canon. There is a whole collection of scriptures, and it's readily available in English translation, pretty good translation. And this is a kind of it kind of extends beyond any particular country's preference for the teachings. I mean, there's Thai Buddhism, which is like different than Sri Lankan Buddhism, but we all go back to the Pali Canon. These are supposedly the direct teachings of the Buddha himself. So that's kind of a foundation of it. And then there is the meditation tradition. There is two principal lines of practice for monks, the study monks and the meditation monks. So basically, if I'm wearing brown, I'm a meditation monk. Yeah, we fit in with the trees, you see. Color, tree color. And the study monks in Thailand, they wear bright orange. Maybe because they don't want to get hit by cars in Bangkok. But wearing bright orange in the forest doesn't quite fit in. So it came from that we actually, to dye the robes, we use the heartwood from the jackfruit tree. Probably don't know what a jackfruit tree is, but it's a kind of an or it's a fruit that's available in Southeast Asia. So we boil up the bark, the heartwood, and make dye out of it, so it becomes brown in the end. So, but the Buddhist tradition, even though it has various expressions, that's why I sort of coined this phrase about harmonizing the spiritual path, because probably each individual comes to the spiritual path from their own interest, their own particular, you can say, their own preferences and tendencies, and maybe even biases. But how to put it all together? How do we arrive at, from our own personal perspectives, how do we arrive at what the Buddha is trying to tell us? And some of these teachings, they do clash with our own particular opinions and views. I mean, most fundamentally, we come from a point of view of our self-interest, and the Buddha is pointing at the truth of selflessness. That's pretty contrary, isn't it? Selflessness, me, selfless? And it just so happened that more recently, I've been making a more in-depth study of this teaching about selflessness, which is one of the most, I would say, most profound and also perhaps one of the most controversial aspects of the Buddhist teachings, especially when it comes to, not just especially in the West, because I think a lot of Asians have a lot of trouble with this too. Yeah, because wherever we are, human beings basically have a self, right? You notice that? Who woke up this morning? It was obviously me, right? Until I looked in the mirror, then that's not me. Not that guy with all those wrinkles and gray hair. No, that's not me. But practically speaking, we start off with a self. And it's probably your self-interest, you know, in whatever degree we can say that, that brought us here today. We have interest. We have interest. It's our self-motivation. It's a certain degree of desire brought us here. You know, maybe we came with the intention to really study about selflessness or something else that would suit myself anyway. I want to be more peaceful. I want to be more wise. How many want to be enlightened? I thought it'd be the minority. Well, actually, what the Buddha found out, I mean, he was seeking for the truth. I think every human being is actually seeking for the truth, because it's only the truth which we can really open to and really feel at peace with. You know, the way things really are, or the truth, or something or other. The Buddha realized that the truth is ultimately selfless. So it's sort of, in a way, a bit paradoxical. Here, I am looking for the truth, but the truth is selfless. So what if I start looking for the truth, and how can I find it? Because myself is in the way, and we got a day to kind of unravel this, maybe. But the Buddha realized that it's not a matter of just thinking about it. That's why I present this as a contemplative investigation of this particular theme. Even to the point where Ajahn Chah once said, if you think about this teaching of not self or non-self or selflessness, your head will explode. See, there I am thinking about not self. There is an I thinking about my not self. So who's thinking about not self and who's thinking and self? You can't figure it out with your rationalization, because your rationalization is a part of yourself. See? Whereas selflessness is beyond that. It's not opposed to it, but it's bigger than that. We have to consider the self, but what's beyond the self too. So the first kind of mistake many people make with studying Buddhism is they think, oh, self is the baddie. I've got to get rid of myself. Careful, careful. No. Don't get rid of yourself. Please, you don't know who you'll be, and you'll just be a problem. But it's really how to work through yourself, or to how to stretch yourself beyond the limitations of your so-called ordinary self. So the Buddha introduced a whole series of various spiritual exercises which can help us. You can say, at one level, it's a little bit of a way of tricking the self into seeing beyond the self. And the very first exercise is the exercise in concentration, focusing your attention on a meditation object, on an object which becomes a meditation object, something very simple, ideally. You don't need to think about. You start thinking about your meditation object, you're still bringing yourself into that process. But if you take something which is non-conceptual, like breathing, you know, maybe first of all we relate to breathing as a concept, you know. What's breathing? I'm breathing, yes. But if you focus on it as a direct object, the more you can actually open to it as a direct experience, the less there's self-involvement in it. Because breathing happens whether you do it or not. Huh? Breathing happens. It even happens before you thought of yourself. Yeah. The young baby born starts breathing before it has a sense of self. You know, psychologically speaking, I think most people, most of the psychologists have the view that a self begins to develop after 2 years, 2 years of age or so. But when we're first born, there's no self, but there is breathing, see. And it's, you don't need to think about it. And fortunately, especially when we fall asleep at night, we have to think about breathing. Some of us would suffocate, wouldn't we? And you can't even stop breathing. I wouldn't suggest you try it, but I mean, physiologically speaking, if you try to stop breathing, you'd pass out and start, the body would start breathing again when you're unconscious. It's just, it's an automatic physical process that goes on without us. So if we use something like that as our point of reference, it can help us to lead us to the, we're still fully conscious, we're fully alive, fully awake, but we've stepped outside all the self-reference. And it can be very peaceful. You know, I'm sure some of you have experienced that already. Somebody? Anybody? When there's just breathing and nobody breathing, it just is the process of breathing and nobody breathing. Just breathing. Ah, what a relaxation. What a peace. This can happen also with other meditation objects. We have a variety of different, traditionally 40 different meditation objects to focus on. Some are a little bit, we say, they're discursive objects, like reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha. So you have to use some kind of thinking. The Buddha is like this, the Buddha is awakened, and the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans and these things. But so you can only sort of settle down or quiet down the self-reference to a limited degree. Other ones, these non-conceptual meditation objects, there are colors, there are physical objects. You can develop deeper states of concentration outside the self-reference. However, breathing is the most common one and the most flexible one, and I would say the most useful for most people, because it's something you have with you all the time wherever you go. If you use a meditation on a certain color, it's hard to keep that color with you when you go to work in the morning. One of the meditation objects in Thailand, anyway, they look at the Buddha image, because it brings up in their mind many positive associations. Yes, the Buddha is sitting there very peacefully, just looking at that facial expression. Doesn't that bring up sort of a sense of peace in your mind? However, when you're going to work in the morning, can you take that Buddha image with you? You know, on the bus? Keep driving, watch where you're driving. But you're breathing. You drive in your car, you're breathing, right? So you can still have a point of reference. Wherever you go, whatever you do, just think of a breath. It can be your point of reference to come back to. And then maybe if you have some experience of peace of mind with using that breathing, then that experience of peace also gets triggered off by that association. See? So there's quite a few different approaches to spiritual practice. I would say, first of all, I would define spiritual as wholeness. I used to think, you know, that the spiritual was kind of opposed to the body and the mind, you see. You know, there is that kind of background, I think, in some spiritual traditions that, you know, there's a spirit is up there and your body is earthbound body down here, and you got to kind of somehow divorce yourself from the body. And even in Buddhist meditation, sometimes people have got the idea that in order to develop these states of tranquility and experience some spiritual peace, you have to stop thinking. Be careful about not thinking. It's not a matter of opposition to it, but you have to include the thinking process in your spiritual practice. You need to include the body in your spiritual practice, not fight against it. That's why Ken mentioned one of the books, the book I finished a couple 2 years ago now. It was about the five hindrances, so-called hindrances. Technically, they're hindrances to developing concentration meditation, but of course, they're also hindrances, you can say, to developing positive spiritual aspirations. But I titled the book Working with the Hindrances, because many people, they've been trying to practice, trying to get rid of them. So many people have asked me, one of the questions I get asked quite frequently, especially in Thailand, is how to get rid of my anger. Say, don't get rid of it. Engage it. Study it. See? And just trying to get rid of your anger is already anger, isn't it? Huh? You're already opposed to your anger, so you're already angry or aggressive towards it or trying to push it away. So that's already a form of anger or aversion. So you're never going to succeed. Aversion against the aversion against the aversion just gets more subtle. So you're a subtly averse person. And actually, it's better to be a coarsely averse person, because then you can really see it. It's pretty obvious. You might lose a few friends, but probably most of your friends. But so if you're a subtly averse person, you got some friends, but they're on edge because you could blow up any minute. But the Buddha is teaching us to engage with it. Of course, not to engage with it at its level, through developing these spiritual exercises, for example, when the mind is a bit more peaceful. The first level of tranquility is it tranquilizes our reactiveness to some of these experiences. So there's something like aversion there or anger. If you can focus on the breathing instead of the anger at the beginning anyway, you quieten down the reactiveness, and it gives you some space now to investigate it from a different perspective, from a calm, peaceful place. And you can see it from a different angle now. And eventually, the point is to try and get to the very source of it. What's triggering it off? What's causing it? Only by uprooting the source of it can it finally be finished. Just trying to suppress it, ignore it, deny it, whatever, is never going to work. Temporarily, maybe, but never in the end. It's not a final solution to it. So initially, I thought that spirituality, I had to go off to Thailand and sit in a cave somewhere and float off the planet, to spirituality land. But now I realize it's not going to work. Maybe when you float off, you probably don't come back. Then they put you in an institution somewhere and give you some drugs. But especially staying with Ajahn Chah, he really emphasized the reality of the Buddha. The Buddha was enlightened in this world. He didn't disappear to some celestial realm and then he was enlightened and came back. He was enlightened right here. Well, not here in Victoria, but on the earth. So in the forest tradition, we emphasize the Buddha renounced his privileged position in society, went off to live in the forest. And he lived in the forest. He was enlightened in the forest, and he actually passed away in the forest. And the forest is sort of symbolic of being with nature, being with the reality of nature. Not in some kind of artificial realm, but in the world, in nature. And this includes body, mind, and you might say spirit in a certain sense, because this is the higher nature of our being, which many of us we may have a little taste of or a little inkling of, but most of us are so preoccupied with looking after the body and looking after our mind, we just don't see it. But it's there all the time. Spirituality is part of the human experience. Most of us are just too busy to notice it, that's all. So basically, I say if spiritual practice does not include the body, it becomes disembodied spirituality. Does that sound familiar? There is quite a bit of disembodied spirituality around, so watch out. If it doesn't involve the emotions, it's disaffected spirituality. There's also some of that around too. doesn't involve the mind. It's dissociated spirituality. There's a lot of that around. But when you bring in all of them into our practice of so-called spirituality, then it becomes complete and whole. That's why I define spirituality as the whole picture, seeing the whole picture. Body, you can say body, emotion, mentality or intellectuality, if you like. When you all come together, then you got the full picture, you got the full experience then of being a human being. And then in that completeness, then you understand spirituality. It's putting it all together. That's what I mean sort of by harmonizing spiritual practice, not separating it from the various parts of ourself. Okay, in the beginning, perhaps we need to, make an effort to, as it were, empower this spiritual aspect, the so-called spiritual aspect of ourselves, the spiritual dimension of ourselves. But I would suggest it's very helpful in the beginning to get off on the right foundation. For example, just this is what the Buddha is teaching too. This isn't just my opinion, I hope. This is my understanding so far after 43 years, Ken, 43. Actually 44, because I was a novice for 1 year in 1973, and then 74 I was a monk. So anyway, after 40 you stop counting. That's why I wasn't sure. Just like after 60 you stop counting, right? But my experiences have been over the years that, to try to integrate all these aspects of our being. So, for example, when I go visit different places, since I have no fixed abode, I have to keep looking for a place to stay. So fortunately, we have quite a few, Ajahn Chah's disciples have quite a few branch monasteries around the world. So to the effect that I can kind of follow the seasons. So it gets cold in Canada, so I go to Thailand in a couple of weeks for the winter. It gets too cold in Thailand. It gets too hot in Thailand. And I go to Australia when it's autumn. But I like to go to a place, my preference is to go to a place where I can, there is the opportunity to develop, I can say the physical exercises, mental exercises, and spiritual exercises. So a place where I can walk in nature. So we have quite a few, in our tradition, quite a few forest monasteries, or monasteries in quiet places. I just spent 2.5 months in Birken Monastery, out far out in the wilderness near Kamloops. And now that it's getting cooler, I look south. By mental exercises, I mean to use some to study, make some study about certain themes, and inquiry, deeper inquiry. Sometimes just conceptually studying something, like reading the scriptures or making a certain study of certain themes, it kind of seeds the meditative inquiry. See? Like it gives you a theme for contemplation. And my understanding is that a lot of the Buddha's teachings are themes for contemplation. See, the Buddha was a meditator primarily. He wasn't just a philosopher philosophizing about the nature of things. He was a meditator trying to realize a direct experience. So, you take up a theme. What is consciousness? Oh, that's too much. I haven't found any answers to that one yet. How about something simpler? What is the body? What is physicality? What is physicality? So you can look in the book and get some kind of general idea about it, but then we develop the spiritual exercises, focusing attention on the breathing, and breathing is a manifestation of physicality. The breathing process is part of physicality. So by focusing on the breathing and then by investigating the breathing process, you begin to learn about physicality at a non-conceptual level, you say. I'll say post-conceptual, pre-conceptual level. Beyond concepts anyway. So you have the concept of what breathing is, But then if you investigate it with a peaceful mind, you begin to experience it directly at a non-conceptual level. And you begin to notice some quite interesting things about something simply as breathing. Huh? Well, I'll leave that for investigation because rather than tell you the results. Or and then the spiritual exercises, I say this is having time and a quiet place for the formal meditation exercises. Generally speaking, you know, living in a very quiet environment, like just recently up in Birken, it's way out in the wilderness and incredibly quiet. There's no sounds. There's the occasional airplane flying over, but no sounds. A few birds twittering and the sound of the wind, but basically the background is just total silence. And probably, you know, living in a city, people don't appreciate what that really means, silence. Usually it's just different levels of noise, quieter noise and louder noise and that. But being in a very quiet place, and then when I was in Thailand, the place I spend most of the time, I live in a cave in Thailand. Have you ever lived in a cave, anybody? Well, I'm the expert. Nobody can argue with me. But you live in a cave, it's very quiet. Very quiet. Except if you're in a bat cave. No. But my cave has no bats. It does have a few mosquitoes. It does have a few bugs and a few lizards and things in it. But very quiet. And having the physical quietude, silence outside, it allows you to hear the inner noise. Normally, we're processing. I mean, just I think physiologically speaking, if you're in a noisy place, your brain has to process all this noise. You probably don't even recognize it, but there's a little voice going on and saying, "What's that noise? That's a car. Okay. What's this noise? Oh, that's a dog barking. Okay." It's going on all the time, and so your certain energy of your mind is already preoccupied. Yeah. So you don't have the full capacity of your mind to observe, you know, what's going on in the mind or the body or something. A certain percentage of your mental energy is already preoccupied. But you live in a quiet place. The quieter the place, the more mental energy is available, potential energy is available to put into mindfulness and awareness and concentration, if you're so inclined. So like when I was at Birken, for example, it was so quiet. If my mind did kind of get caught up with things, I just stop and listen to the silence. Ah. Reminds me, and it's silence. It puts that this activity in this brain into the right perspective. Because silence is a deeper reality. Have you ever noticed? You hear it? The silence is there, and then unfortunately I have to fill it up with a few words. Maybe a lot of words. But you notice the silence is there all the time. It's the background. And then the noise comes into it. So the Buddha even said that the mind is intrinsically radiant, but it's disturbed by things that come into it. And if you notice the things that come into it, it's usually thoughts about me, right? So you're filling up your own mind with yourself. And then it's more complicated than that. You fill up your mind with your self-reference, and then, oh, I've got to do this to myself, and I've got to do that to myself, and oh, myself has this problem and that problem, and back to the silence, no problem. Silence has no problems. Only you have the problem. Yourself has the problem, but silence doesn't. Very simple, very basic. However, it's a lot easier said than done. Have you ever tried to listen to the silence? What's the silence? Where is it? Is this right? Is that wrong? But it is possible to use that as a point of reference, you know, and it can be helpful to get a certain perspective on your mental activity. I know I previously, before I knew much about Buddhist meditation, You know, my understanding was that I can think myself through all my problems. You know, I'm intelligent. I got a scholarship to UBC. I must be intelligent. I didn't think I was, but somebody must have. So I can think myself through all my problems, but I hit the wall at a certain point. Then I had to find another way to approach it. But it was quite difficult, I must admit, because I had spent 20-odd years using that device, that particular means to solve my problems, just thinking. So it wasn't so easy just to turn it off. In fact, it was impossible to turn it off, actually. But using some of the Buddha's techniques for meditation practice, instead of trying to turn off your mind or trying to not think, you put your attention on the breathing, and breathing is not conceptual. So in order to actually be aware of breathing, basically you have to stop thinking. But if you try and stop thinking, there's me trying to stop my thinking, it doesn't work. If it does, it's probably based on repression. So there's another ego, another you trying to stop your thinking. So there's still ego in it. But if you turn to the breathing, there's no ego in it. Breathing just happens. So there's a selfless, egoless way to step away from your preoccupation with your thoughts. Do you believe me, or maybe we should try it? Yes, yeah, right. I can hear the thinking about it. Yes, that's why I think it's time to to watch the breath. So.